Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, episode 52, and I'm your host, Nick Ortigo. How science can make literature come to life. Plus, we have a few free summer professional development offerings and an Idaho lawsuit asks schools to repay student fees they charged your child. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, we chat with Dr. Jo Bowler about how she's reforming math education through ucubed.org. Hello, everybody. Nick Ortigo here, and I'm joined by teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt. And Russ actually has a day off today. So, Lissa, how are you doing?
I'm good. Tomorrow's the last day of school.
Is it really?
Yep.
Okay. Well, this is actually going to air a little bit later, but that's okay. We'll just pretend. Happy wrapping up school for some folks. And you know, school's in at different times everywhere. Where I grew up, we didn't get out to like middle of June, June 20th, June 15th. It usually was somewhere around there.
I think some schools in Texas are already out for 2 weeks now.
Well, actually, I'm interviewing somebody from Texas tomorrow, so I will find out. In fact, I'm interviewing a guest that we had on the show. Remember the teacher of the year out of Texas?
Yes.
I want to hear about her trip to Washington, D.C., you know, because she got to go to the White House and all that. Yeah. And what was the scoop?
Yeah. And all the other teachers of the year went there, right?
Right. Yeah. They all meet up.
So she got to meet a bunch of other teachers. That'd be cool.
And I'm also really excited about today's interview. I spoke with a professor of education out of Stanford University, Jo Bowler, and she created this website called ucubed.org, and it has a huge following. They've had like 24 million page views in the past couple of years, and she's telling us about how I don't think I'm a math person, right? Well, she's going to explain to me why that's all baloney. Like, right. We're all math people.
Yeah, you just got to approach it a different way.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's the summertime, but there's still always some education stories out there. And I know you're bringing one to the teacher's lounge. What do you know?
Well, and to be quite honest, teachers do a ton of work over the summer to prepare for the upcoming year. Definitely when they're trying to change things up in their classroom as far as the way they implement, you know, subject matter and try to have a new approach. So this is perfect. This is out of Edutopia. And it's talking about science. We always try to integrate science. You know, that's a big push because so many people feel a disconnect when it comes to science. I can speak to this. I am just, like you're saying, you don't feel like you're math-minded. Mm-hmm. I really don't feel like I am scientifically wired in any way. Like, right. It's just so foreign to me, and I don't like sci-fi stuff. And I just, everything is so out there and abstract that it's hard for me to tune in. But
I mean, did you like the movie Inception?
I mean, it was out there. Like, it was just the whole time I was like, what is happening? You know, it's a great day that Russ is not here today because honestly, he would be like, what? Anyway, so this is talking about we're always trying to integrate science and help, you know, like maybe you'll try to get your students to read a sci-fi novel so that you can pat yourself on the back and say that you're, you know, pulling science in. But actually, it's saying, nope. Actually, language arts needs some help from science, that a lot of people feel a disconnect to language arts, and some of the novels that they're reading are just so out there to other people. They use the example of Beowulf. You know, that's such a rich, rich text, and it's just hard to understand and muddle through. And they, you know, tried to incorporate art into Beowulf and things to, you know, hopefully make it have a lasting impact on students, but it doesn't work. But this article talks about using science to help the readers connect to Beowulf, and it worked.
So I understand science helps in literature.
That's right.
In English class.
That's right.
Okay.
It's a completely different, you know, it's a reverse of what we normally do.
Right.
So what they did was they did some projects where you had to create, you know, Beowulf or Grendelin. Am I saying that right?
You're asking the wrong guy.
No.
Are you talking about like the Harry Potter?
The dragon. No. Grendel. Okay. So they had the students create like models, you know, 3D models of Beowulf or Grendel, the dragon thing. And so what they did was they made them create LED circulatory system that lights up using batteries and things like that.
Well, that's cool.
They talked about the impact of losing a limb, losing an arm, and, you know, what happens there and blood flow and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
They also had battle bots. So you had to make your robot or, you know, not maybe I shouldn't say robot, but your 3D character battle.
Yeah.
And
but do you think, okay, this is fun. These are cool side projects. But do you think this makes the students want to read the book? Do you think, like, you build a battle bot and you're like, well, I'm going to read today?
Well, I mean, it's definitely a way to lighten the muddled down text of Beowulf.
Okay.
So, it, you know, like, I remember in high school when we did Beowulf, they had a, I don't know, like a life-size armor or whatever.
See, I don't remember like, Beowulf, so I'm thinking I just slid by somehow. Like, I'm thinking I just, like...
You may not have taken that course. I mean, it...
No, I remember possessing the book.
Oh, great.
But I don't... And I remember taking a test, but I don't remember reading Beowulf.
Well, here's what I recall. I recall we had to save Tap Tops from Coca-Cola cans and things and bring in Tap Tops. The whole school was collecting Tap Tops, and we affixed them to this armature... to make a chainmail, you know, covering of Beowulf.
So y'all like ripped off the thing that's supposed to keep people from littering and you made chainmail.
Probably, I guess. Okay. And so, So, but that was it. That was what we did. That was our fun activity or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, I have to say, someone that I'm not scientifically wired in any way, if we were able to creatively... work in groups to create a circulatory system and make it connect to a battery, you know, which is then making it light up. It might have helped me, I think. I think it would have helped me, especially with the bogging down of, you know, the text and how
you keep talking abstract. This must be a boring book.
It's a lot.
I mean, it sounds
a lot. It'll be like one sentence. It's like a paragraph.
And what's cool is it sounds like, not having read the book, but it sounds like, you know, the book's cool when you talk about the science stuff that you're talking about, but then you keep going back to like...
That's right.
It's a snoozer.
Well, and the book, I mean, honestly, and there are people out there that are going to say, oh my gosh, I can't believe she just said that, but blasphemy. It's like it's a great plot. There's a great plot to Beowulf. It's a great like heroic story, but it kind of could be just summed up real fast, but it's not. Another example they use is Frankenstein. Now, this is where I became... interested because I am a little more artsy. But one of the main themes of Frankenstein, or I guess the Achilles heel of Frankenstein, is that the scientist was so focused on, can I do this? Can I put these things together and make this, you know, human-like figure that operates? And, you know, so he was so focused on that he forgot about the beauty of what he was creating. And so Frankenstein is obviously not attractive. And so the fact that put together, the fact that he was just, you know, haphazardly put together just for function, but not necessarily for form and beauty, the world treated Frankenstein badly. So then he was not a monster, but he became a monster because of the way he was treated.
Yeah.
And then there's a part in the novel where he says to... you know, his creator, like, why did you do this to me?
There might be a nature versus nurture lesson there.
So they integrate science into the literature of Frankenstein by having students create robots. And again, the robots need to battle and this and that, but also so they can do the whole circulatory thing and all that. But also they have to talk about, okay, wait a minute, what about function and how much do science, you know, function versus beauty and how much do scientists have to notice that even when they're designing cars and things, like how much does beauty play into it? Even, you know, with something like a vacuum, like how much does beauty really need to play into it? And it's actually a ton. It actually plays in a ton. And so that kind of pulls in more of the art, you know, area. So I just thought it was a really interesting way to, you know, if you're thinking, if you cover these same novels in high school every year, like maybe over the summer, prepare to have a junk sculpture competition going where you're using things like, you know, forks and old doorknobs and things, and you create a junk sculpture but you know, it's somehow related to Frankenstein, and you're trying to encompass all these themes.
You know, I love it. Back in episode 43, we did we interviewed a teacher, a math teacher out of Tennessee, about how he reads a novel to his pre-algebra class, like a novel, like a literary book. And that interview was really interesting to me, because you normally don't hear that, but this is kind of the reverse, as you were saying.
Yeah.
And I like it.
I like it too. It's different.
Good stuff. Well, you know, as we're talking about, the summer's basically here for some folks and almost here for others. So I found a pretty cool article on EdSurge about some free ed type development courses that you can kind of get. Now, this isn't going to be accessible to everyone, but some of these are actually online and some are near big cities and stuff. So it kind of depends on where you live. But for example, PBS is hosting a free EdCamp event in New York City, where educators are encouraged to collaborate with schools and home-based teachers to share practices and develop schools. You like the coding, you know?
Oh, yeah.
You love it?
Yeah.
Code.org is working with partners across the United States to bring a one-day workshop to K through 5 teachers. This one you have to apply in order to take part. And then it looks like they're going to have some locations and stuff. Again, I'm going to put all these on our show notes. So if you just want to kind of go through and look at the whole list, what type of educational development would you do if, you know, would you want to do in the summertime?
I would, in the math area, I would definitely want to attend something that helps you use the smart board or Promethean boards in your classroom for more interactive games and things like that, that you, where you have the whole student, you know, all the children in the class are answering and chiming in through their cell phones, and that, you know, there's a lot of that going on now that's really neat and cool, but it's hard if you're not somebody that is just ready to take that on. You want someone to hold your hand through it. I would invest in something like that, because that's something that won't cost you anything to implement into your classroom if you already have a smart board.
Remember we talked about the one in NASA, or it's in Huntsville, Alabama, I guess, the NASA program. That's hard to get into, I know. But if anyone's listening that's been to that, I want to talk to you. Like, I want to hear about that summer camp.
Yeah.
Because that's really cool. And I mean, I'm sure I could probably go track somebody down, but if we just happen to have a listener, I'd love to.
Right. I know parents and children that have attended it, but I have never known a teacher to attend the camp. Right?
I want to hear just like how awesome this thing is. There's a guy named Chris Emden, and he's an author and associate professor at the Department of Mathematics, Science, and Technology at Columbia University. And he spoke at South by Southwest EDU recently, and apparently it was like this incredible keynote speech for anybody who's into ed tech. Well, this summer in New York City, he's going to be joined for a Teachers by Teachers conference called Ed by Ed NYC to deliver, I guess, another version of that keynote address, and tickets are free. So that's going to be in New York City. So if you happen to be around then. Again, all these are going to be the whole article with EdSurge. It's really a great one. Just kind of has some free resources. And there's a few things that you can do online too. A free media literacy course that's available through PBS and just kind of get you set up for the summer. Okay, so there's an interesting legal case, and this is one of those cases where I think some parents will agree with, but when we really take a step back, you're going to kind of be like, I don't know, this is kind of shaky ground, and here's what it is. It's taking place in Idaho, and there's a lawsuit asking Idaho schools to repay the student fees that are charged to your child. In other words, like, if you have to pay a lab fee for an advanced placement course at a school in Idaho, there was a ruling a couple of years ago that basically says that is unconstitutional according to the Idaho Constitution.
Okay, so let me get this straight. Yeah. So they're asked to pay the lab fee.
Yeah, an extra cost.
And then
cost.
Now they're asking the school district to actually reimburse the parents back for that, because they should have never asked for
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And a guy won 2 years ago.
Wow.
But the judge only made the reimbursement go to him. It wasn't like a class action suit that represented everyone.
Well,
apparently now the guy's like, well, I'm going back. I mean, precedent set. The judge said this has already been ruled on. So they're going after that for everyone. And it also may apply to like after school activities, sporting activities, because you're a mom, you have kids that you know, are in sports.
$80 just to play through the summer, but it's required for us to do the summer games for soccer and such, but $80. Yeah.
And then uniforms when you get to the actual season.
Right.
I mean, what do you think you're in through? Let's forget the tax dollars that you put into a public school when your child is in the band or football team or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it varies definitely, and some are way more expensive than others. You know, show choir can get way up there, and band. But I have to say, for an athlete, you know, my oldest child plays football and soccer, so let's see, that'd be probably $500 or $600 for the year. That's summer, fall, spring, you know, that's uniforms, cleats.
Yeah.
That's summer practice, that's summer mandatory camp, you know, those kind of things. That, yeah, it gets up there.
It says the class action lawsuit was filed May 9th in federal court. It names as its plaintiffs specific students and parents at two school districts in eastern Idaho and all similarly situated patrons and students at 115 school districts and approximately 50 charter schools. Jeez. The lawsuit focuses on school supply costs and other fees charged to students and their families when the student wants to enroll in specific classes. And then he also goes on to talk about those extracurricular activities.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a lab fee, an art fee, a, you know, there's a technology fee. Wow. I mean, part of me as a parent, or I mean, excuse me, part of me as a teacher says, oh no, there's not enough money for us to do some of the things that we need to do. So of course we need that lab fee to be able to order the frogs for dissection, you know? Mm-hmm. But I can see as a parent, they're like, well, good, pay us back, you know, but it's just, ugh, you know. And I mean, I will say, I know as a teacher that not everybody pays those fees. That is the frustrating part, is if you have a, you know, 400 kids going through your biology program, you know that only 100 probably paid the lab fee, so they're paying it for everyone else, and that's probably what some of this is coming from, is that, you know, if you're not going to make it mandatory for everybody, then it shouldn't be, you know, only expected or required from some.
So apparently it is a constitutional right to have this, you know, free and fair education, and, mm-hmm. and it's probably like that in a lot of states, but what does that mean? And now that's going to have to be interpreted by the courts, and it could get a little bit messy. I think, you know, certainly something worth watching over in Idaho. I don't know if it's kind of a frivolous thing, or if there's the fact that it was 1-2 years ago on an individual basis says, you know, maybe there's something to it. So
I do think as a parent, if you're going to have a child involved in some kind of extracurricular, like band, show choir, theater, mm-hmm. soccer, football, cheerleading, you've got to be prepared to pay some expense.
What about like a lab fee for
I think that's different. So I do think,
do yes. you know of that happening?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Even with Algebra 3, you know, those graphing calculators are so crazy expensive mm-hmm. to go purchase one. You're looking at $120, $150. You know, we've had an episode on that.
Yeah, last week.
Well, what I liked, but some people didn't like, is that if you didn't want to go buy that, you could just pay a rental fee, $30 yeah. cash to the math teacher, and she would give you a calculator to use. So she had a class set of calculators that we know have been paid for 100 times over by now, yeah. you know?
Well, you're talking about math and calculators. We have a math rock star on the show today. Are you ready for the bright idea?
Yes, this is going to be good.
Yeah, it is. Dr. Jo Bowler, she's out of Stanford University, and she also created this amazing website, ucube.org. But she is like the leading voice for reforming math education.
I love it.
And for the record, she's British, so she's going to say maths. So we'll just have to accept that. She's probably right, and we're wrong, but anyhow, without further ado. Our guest in today's Bright Idea segment is Dr. Jo Bowler. Dr. Bowler is a professor of mathematics education at the Stanford Graduate School of Education. She's also a driving force behind the popular instructional resource ucubed.org and author of Mathematical Mindsets. Dr. Bowler, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, it's really an honor to have you here, and I think you're going to probably set me straight today, because when I was in high school, I just kind of accepted that I was not a math person, and you're going to help yes. me understand why I'm ridiculous and really...
Well, I totally understand why you would think that, because of the terrible system we have out there in many cases. But yes, it's true that anybody can learn maths. We now have all of that evidence from the brain science. Unfortunately, the teaching that's out there conveys a lot of messages to young people. The teaching, the culture, TV, and other things, that there are math people and non-math people.
You said something there. We have the brain science. And I listened to a TED Talk that you did. Like, mm-hmm. you literally mean, like, this. There is actual evidence that,
yes.
you know, this is ridiculous to say that your brain's not programmed for math.
Exactly, yes. So all the neuroplasticity, it's decades now of evidence that tells us that nobody's born with the pathways that are mathematical pathways in the brain. But in fact, those come every time we learn something. And I like to show a visual, which I can't show with this podcast, but every time we learn, there's one of three things that happen in the brain. You either start a new brain pathway, which is a very delicate pathway at first, and then it becomes stronger and stronger, or you connect two pathways that weren't connected, or you strengthen a pathway. Those are the three things that happen when you learn something. And the more we learn, the more mathematical pathways we develop in the brain. Now, nobody's born with those pathways. So learning maths really is about experiences of learning. And you can learn whatever you want to learn. There aren't limits to what we can learn. And everybody can be successful in maths.
So what are we doing wrong in the classroom right now with math?
Ooh, where do I start?
Right.
So what are we doing wrong? I would say... an emphasis on speed is very, very damaging in mathematics. And we have time testing. It's particularly damaging when little kids are given lots of math facts to memorize and regurgitate. At that point, when they're given those time tests, many of them develop maths anxiety. And from that point onwards, it's downhill for them. It's not just the rapid time tests that are damaging or that give the idea of speed when teachers ask a question and then they take an answer from the first kid that shoots up their hand. They're also giving a clear message to the rest of the class that speed is what's valued. So a lot of people think you have to be very fast with numbers to be good at maths. That's a misconception. I like to share the stories of lots of mathematicians who will openly talk about how slow they are with maths, how they were never fast, wow, how they thought they were stupid when they were in school because speed was what was valued. So that's one of the things we really need to change, the idea that to be good at maths, you have to be fast.
When I was in school, it was almost frowned upon to use your fingers. And
yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's not right, right? We should allow...
That's another thing we need to change, yes. So another really important part of brain science is showing us that visual thinking is really important in mathematics. Every time you think about maths, there are five pathways in the brain that light up. Two of them are visual. So every time we think visually, it's actually very important. And a piece of this visual research has also shown that fingers are really important. So if I was to ask an adult to do a calculation, an area of the brain would light up that is seeing fingers.
Mm. And even if you're not using your fingers, you're kind of seeing them, you're
that's
saying?
That's right. Yeah. You're not using them, but your brain kind of sees them. And for adults, even, how well they know their fingers predicts their scores on calculation tests. It's pretty crazy.
But can you elaborate on that? Because I heard you talk about this, and, mm-hmm. and I didn't quite get it. It was, you were kind of trying to describe it, I guess, as if you have your hands underneath a table?
Oh, yeah. So the tests that the neuroscientists do for finger perception, they call knowing your fingers really well finger perception. And they test how well you know your fingers by having you put your hands somewhere you can't see them, under a table, under a book, and then somebody touches each fingertip, and not in order, and you're meant to say which fingertip is being touched. So if you try that with young children, you'll discover that they're just developing this finger perception. They may be better with their dominant hand than their other hand. And they may be kind of slow or really struggling to work out which finger is being touched. So this is also, we now know, why musicians are often better with maths.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
People have wondered about this for years. Like, what's this connection between maths and music? Why so many musicians, mathematicians? And this is a piece of it, that most musicians develop very fine-tuned finger perception.
So what can we do to keep from crushing students' spirits when it comes to math?
Well, that's a great question. So we do lots of things wrong. I was just only beginning with the speed piece. Right. But the other thing we do wrong is we teach formal maths probably too early to kids. If you look at the successful countries like Finland, nobody does any formal mathematics till after the age of 7. Before that time, they play with ideas and shapes and puzzles, but they're not taught things like long division and multiplication. That comes later. Now, those kids in Finland then go on to top the world in maths achievement when they're 15. So we know that we don't need to teach kids formal maths very early. And that's one of the things we do wrong. For many kids, their first experience of maths is confusion. Then we teach maths as a set of methods and procedures when actually it's a set of ideas. And a lot of kids think that their role in maths classrooms is to memorize the methods that teachers set out. Mm-hmm. We need to change that perception. We have taught a summer camp a couple of years ago where we taught maths differently to kids. We brought in 81 students to Stanford. Most of them, actually all of them, said, "I'm not a math person," when they came in. Mm-hmm. But we taught the maths in a different way. And one of the parts of what we did was the maths was visual and it was creative. And a really important piece was we valued all the different ways students saw the ideas and all the different ways they thought about the ideas. So it was all about multiplicity, like what are the many different ways we can think about this and the many different ways we can solve this. And we would have these great discussions about the different ways people saw it. And so that's very different to your standard maths class where the teacher puts methods on the board and the kids reproduce them.
I know you're an advocate for what you call number talks. Can you kind of explain what that is?
Yeah, number talks are amazing, actually. I learned them from Kathy Humphreys, who has books about them, and Ruth Parker. They both have written about number talks. So what happens in a number talk is you ask a class a calculation kind of question. And a favorite one I like to use is 18 times 5. And you ask them to work it out in their head without pen and paper. And then you collect in any answers that kids have. Usually there's more than one. You put those up on the board and then say, okay, who would like to defend one of these? Who can tell me how they got this? So we did these with our summer camp kids every day. And as an example, if I were to ask 18 times 5, usually there's 4 or 5 different ways of solving that. So some people might say, well, I didn't work out 18 times 5. I worked out 20 times 5, and then I took away 10. Other people might say, well, I worked it out by saying 10 times 5 and 8 times 5. Other people say, well, instead of working out 18 times 5, I worked out 9 times 10. So they halved the 18 and doubled the 5. So you then collect all these different methods. I like to draw them as well as visuals. Now, whenever I've done this with kids, they're mind blown by it. Adults also. And part of the reason for that is usually they've grown up thinking there's one way to solve a problem. So when I ask 18 times 5 and we have 6 different ways to solve it, that's shocking for kids. Mm-hmm. So I love number talks. They're kind of, they engender the creativity in maths because we get all these different ways of looking at it and different ways of thinking about it. They help kids with mental maths, with calculating, but they get to see that maths is a subject where you have all these different ways of thinking. And I always call the strategy, I put the kids' names up for each strategy. So like, this is Nick's strategy and this is Joe's strategy. And then later I might say to them, okay, can anybody take Nick's strategy and use that for 12 times 5? And so people would use Nick's strategy on a different number. It's part of my big mission, I guess, which is to make maths a subject that's very visual and creative and all about multiple different ways of seeing and solving it.
So let's talk about the mission a little bit. I mean, you're a professor at one of the best universities in the country, if not the world, in terms of teaching education. So you can affect those who are at least going into the educational system, but that's a pretty small number of people that you can really teach. So is that your idea behind ucube.org, is to almost reach more people pretty much?
Definitely. Yes. UCube came about actually a few summers ago when I taught an online class. I'd been hanging out with the people at Udacity and Sebastian Thrun, and there was a lot of excitement about online classes. And I thought, why don't I make a class that shares this brain science? It's so important that everybody can do well in maths, that mistakes are really one of the greatest times for your brain. And So I put it into an online class. I had no idea if anybody would take it. But that summer it released, 15,000 maths teachers took it. Wow. Or maybe it was 30,000. It was a huge number of maths teachers anyway. And at the end of the class, a lot of people were saying, can we have more? We, you know, this has been great, but please keep giving us more things. So that was when U-Cubed was born. Myself, I sat down with a colleague of mine, Kathy Williams, who was the director of mathematics in a school district at the time in San Diego. And we said, why don't we make something where we can keep getting these ideas out to teachers? So I still remember a couple of years ago, I guess, our first month, we had about 5,000 visits to the site. We were very excited about that. We're now just short of 25 million. There's a lot of excitement. People really like the resources. We try and make everything free on the site. There's a couple of things, like we have some curriculum books and online classes that you buy, but the vast majority of the site is free lessons for teachers, little white papers that share evidence, lots of tasks, just individual tasks that teachers can use, videos for kids. We make lots of mindset videos to change kids' ideas about maths. And one of the things I'm excited about, actually, that's on the site is we made a little student online class. It's free. It's six sessions that are about 15 minutes each. And we've just completed a study. It's just released. Actually, the results of this have just released that the kids who take the class end up doing significantly better in maths on standardized tests. They also change their mindset and their ideas about maths. So lots of resources on the site.
I saw a quote from the dean of the Graduate School of Education, Dan Swartz, and he says that you're the public face of K-12 mathematics reform. So if you could, if it's not too much pressure, give yourself a grade. How are you doing? Or have you changed math around the world? Or do you guys have a really long way
to go? Yes. Well, one of the things we advocate is getting rid of grading. So I won't give myself a grade. But I think I'm happy. I'm very happy that we're as widely used as we are. We have most of our participants are in California. It's the biggest state, which is where we're located. And then the US is the biggest country of the numbers of people. But we're also very popular in Canada and the UK. But our newsletter is opened in 140 countries, which always blows me away. I can't even imagine 140 countries. But so I feel like we're doing well. But I don't feel that we're doing well enough because I don't know, maybe we are known by 500,000 maths teachers, maybe. Mm-hmm. But actually, there's 15 million maths teachers in the United States. And I don't mind if teachers come to U-Cubed and think, oh, I don't like any of this, I don't want to use it. But I would like them to at least know it's there because it's a free resource. And many teachers who know about it are really, you know, happy they know about it.
I know you have a pretty big following on Twitter. You're at Joe Baller, your name, on Twitter, if anyone wants to find you that hasn't already found you. But is that the place you really like to reach out and communicate with educators, or is there another spot?
I do like Twitter. Twitter's a big one for me. I like Twitter a lot. There's something about Twitter users, or at least the ones I'm connected with, it seems like a very open-minded space, although I know there's plenty of kind of haters on Twitter. But for the most part, it seems that when I put out ideas on Twitter, it's a really amazing group of people who discuss the ideas and try things and come back and talk about them. So I don't feel that the people on Twitter that I'm interacting with are those who are not really passionate about teaching, who just turn up because it's a job. I think the passionate, caring educators and teachers who really want good things for their kids and are willing to read research and try new things. So I think it's a really great community.
Well, we really appreciate you reaching out to our listening community and the educators that we have that follow our show. And hopefully, if they hadn't heard of you, they'll jump on board and check out youtube.org. Are you ready for our pop quiz?
Sure, yes.
All right, first question. If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be?
This kills me. English.
English. See, I love it. I love it that you didn't say what we thought you would say, you know? What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
We are not teaching kids to be creative and flexible enough. It's too much rule following and memorization.
What does every child deserve?
Every child deserves a set of teachers who believe in them and who know that they can do anything and that they can really succeed.
What's the biggest challenge for today's educators?
I think for teachers in schools, they're really challenged because they are controlled by people above them who set out curriculum and pacing guides and assessments. So we work with many teachers who would love to give their kids an open, creative visual maths experience, but they feel constrained by the standards and curriculum and other things that are imposed upon them.
What's the best gift to give an educator?
Knowledge, I would say, is the best gift for an educator. When we know new things and learn new things, that changes who we are as people. I like to share a framework of learning as identity. When we learn new things, we become different people. We can see the world differently. So I think knowledge and learning.
Which teacher changed your life?
Gosh, that would have to probably be my maths A-level teacher in England. A-levels are the kind of advanced things you do when you're 17, 18. And I had had maths teachers my whole life who just came and put methods on the board and we just had to follow them. And then I had this amazing woman teacher, and it was one of the few women maths teachers I'd had also, who got us to talk about maths together and discuss ideas, and it just changed the whole subject for me.
And last question, pen or pencil?
Pen.
Pen. See, I think you'd think math folks would want to erase stuff, you know, but no.
We like mistakes, you know, mistakes are good.
That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or a comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and hit that subscribe button, and we'd also love it if you'd leave us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismiss. On behalff of Russ with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortigo, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed!